Warning, we are a vulgarity-filled, sometimes offensive, spoilers-based podcast. And while we make no apologies for the chaotic mess which we call a podcast, much like that drunken uncle at your family reunion, we will have deep-seated regrets in the morning. Thank you for taking the time to listen to us, and remember, you have been warned. Welcome to Cinematic Anarchy, the podcasting equivalent of a roll of quarters thrown into a blender on high speed. With me today, we have Mr. Omar.
He is I, and I am him. How's it going, everybody?
It's going. It's going. It's been snowing.
Which is better than not going.
Which is definitely better than not going. If it wasn't going at all, then, this would be a very different podcast. Possibly a podcast in memoriam.
The mind-blowing stagnation.
Right. So today we're going to go ahead and sit down and discuss a film that we probably should have done a long, long time ago. Mr. Omar, when we first started this podcast, actually wrote a review for this film. So if you scroll back through the mountains of stuff that we've added to our Facebook page, you can find a review for Six String Samurai that Omar had written himself. If not, you can just listen to us shoot the shit right now. You don't have to scroll back. We'll talk about it. It's a good film.
It's a very good film for a bad, low-budget movie.
So we can't actually toss this into the low-budget category. Do you know what this was?
Yeah.
The director, the man that directed and wrote this film, Lance Mungia, I believe that's what his last name is. This was actually his student film. So technically, yes, low budget. It falls into that category, but it was a student film. So most student films in general are very, very low budget.
Lowish budget.
You pull all sorts of strings to try to get things done on nothing. As a matter of fact, from what I was listening to in the documentary for the film, he actually had a deal with Panavision to basically get the equipment on weekends free of charge. So the equipment he used for the movie, he didn't pay for.
That was a deal. Get the executive some drugs. Clean the parking lot.
Right? You can't get any better than free.
So. No. The problem is there's no such thing as free. Everything comes with a price.
Right. So there's a lot to unpack for this particular film. It is a musically based movie set in post-apocalyptic United States, where the only bastion for freedom still left in existence is Las Vegas. Of all places, right? This feels a lot like, I don't know if you've played those video games, Fallout?
Yeah.
Fallout games? But this feels a lot like a side story to the Fallout New Vegas game that they did. In this particular case, the king, Elvis Presley, was obviously running Las Vegas till he died, and now all of these different musicians are scrambling to get to Las Vegas to be
the king. The new king.
The king, yes. King, baby. of course, all being led, or not led by, but the lead in this particular film is Buddy. Which is sort of a pseudo Buddy Holly emulation done by Jeffrey Falcon.
Yeah.
They actually decided to center this around Buddy Holly because one evening while they were sitting down and going through how they wanted to do this movie, the director was sitting down with Jeffrey Falcon, who helped write the film with him. He took his glasses, which were these broken horn-rimmed glass things with a little bit of tape in the middle, and put them on Jeffrey. And he says, you know, with those on, you look a lot like Buddy Holly. He goes, that's exactly what we should do for this film. This should be a post-apocalyptic Buddy Holly movie. And there we have our film. That's exactly what this is. Basically, Buddy Holly being chased.
When I wrote that review for that film, the way I should have started that review is a twist-packed ditty that couldn't have come out of a sober mom.
It's basically a post-apocalyptic Buddy Holly movie that pictures Buddy Holly being chased down by Slash from Guns N' Roses the entire film.
Pretty much.
You can't tell me that Death was not Slash. Like, they didn't have him in mind when they did that.
Yeah, I'm sure they did.
And
I'm sure Slash might have gotten a laugh out of it.
I missed the first few watching of this film. I missed why the kid was following Buddy the entire film. I missed it. in the very opening sequence to the film, Buddy saves the kid after his mother is killed by, I'm guessing some of Death's Marauders?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it looked like anyway. She was shot down by the same arrows that Death ends up killing Buddy with by the end of the film. Now, by the way, spoiler alert. Fuck that. We do the spoiler alert at the beginning of the podcast. If they weren't listening, I don't care.
Yeah, it's not like this is live and they came in while after it had started.
No, no, no. It's we have you and Miss B doing our spoiler alert for the beginning of the podcast only because every time I listen to the one I did, it is so grating that I just can't stand myself at all.
Sit yourself down.
Well, did you hear the one that I did? When we sat down and did all those things, I actually had one that had an air raid siren at the beginning of it. So, that was my spoiler alert. I did the standard spoiler alert, but with, like, an air raid siren. And the gentleman across the street had listened to that and listened to a couple of other ones, and he said that he preferred yours.
Who heard what?
The gentleman that right across the street at the convenience store. He actually listens to the podcast, and he likes your little intro, your spoiler alert. All right, pussies, this has been your final warning.
He
loved that. He loved that. Couldn't get enough. So, our post-apocalyptic Buddy Holly movie basically is a road movie. You have him going from point A to point B, trying to get to Vegas to be the new king. And the entire time, he is trailed by the kid. Doesn't have a name other than that, who seems to only speak in loud grunts, just, the entire movie.
I know.
This is how you know he is there. This is how Buddy knows that he is close by, this just loud, And there's an entire part where Buddy and him go back and forth, where he groans out, and then Buddy just goes, right back to him. shortly before bouncing a gumball off the pavement in post-apocalyptic Vegas land there, and then puts it in his mouth. So, you know, everything in my head, you know, post-COVID, says that is the fucking dirtiest thing that you could, just bouncing anything that you're going to put your mouth on off the road and then putting it in your mouth. All sorts of shit could have been out there, from roadkill to fucking tire rubber to oil, blah, blah. Good job, Buddy.
I must say, though, Jeffrey Falcon, the guy that played Buddy, I'm going to assume he has some kind of training.
So Jeffrey Falcon, before he actually hit this film, had done several films, I want to say in Japan. Either Japan or Korea, where he basically played the white bad guy in those films.
Okay, that explains a lot, because the swordsmanship was, as somebody that's into you know, martial arts movies, I could tell you right off the bat, the swordsmanship wasn't bad.
He was steeped a lot in different martial arts films. As a matter of fact, he's the one that did all of the fight choreography for this film. So all the fight choreography, he was involved in that. He was involved in a lot of set production. He did all the costume design in this film as well. So he was like an everyman throughout this entire film.
So he was pretty much co-producer in a way, co-director.
Exactly. He starred in such films, these are what he's known for anyway, as, let's see, he was in Caged Beauties, The Happy Partner, he played in a movie called Rape in Public Sea, Mr. Men's Bodyguard, what else was there? A lot of these are in Japanese, so I cannot actually read them. But he starred in a number of Asian films, from like 1998 on to this film, Six String Samurai, in 1998. So about 10-year span, 88 to 98. And this was the last film that he was known to have done.
Oh, wow.
So, he said, I guess he said in an interview a while back, that if he was only ever known for doing this film, he is perfectly fine with this being his legacy. And I can see why. I mean, this, for it being a student film, it was really fucking well done.
Yeah, it was. And they managed to do the little, I would say, combination, alternation of the comical and the action in, you know, elements.
There were a lot of things throughout the film that stood out to me. Like, did you notice the initial scene where they run across the Red Elvises?
Yeah.
As he's exiting the scene, he runs across a guy with a straw hat who is supposed to be their spoof of Clint Eastwood. Even so far as doing a small spoof on one of his most famous lines, you know, go ahead, make my day.
Mm-hmm.
Just as he's shooting or going to shoot our lead character, Buddy, a spark goes off and lights gasoline under his feet. And he's like, oh, I guess this just isn't my day.
It is. Yeah, I remember.
There were a lot of really spot on. I mean, there were puns, but they didn't feel out of place. They made it so it felt just like active banter throughout the movie. It was fun to watch and sort of pick things apart throughout the entire film. Buddy spends half the film looking for a ratchet, even trying to trade the kid off for a ratchet a couple times, one to a cannibalistic family, and two... I'm guessing, was this supposed to be, like, the guy that they run across, Little Man, later on in the movie?
Yeah.
Was that supposed to be, like, a spoof on The Wizard of Oz?
Possibly. The guy that said, follow the yellow brick road.
There were a lot of Wizard of Oz elements throughout the entire film. Like them trying to get to the Emerald City, which is, in this case, Fallout Vegas.
Post-Fallout Vegas.
Post-Fallout Vegas. As a matter of fact, there is a town called Fallout just outside of Vegas that they mention halfway through the film. Mind you, it's mentioned through the radio commentary that's provided by the pseudo-Wolfman Jack commentator.
Probably named after the incident.
More than likely. Because, I mean, they showed that there was a nuclear bomb that went off, like, early in the film? Like, that's what kind of froze everything in 1957?
Exactly. The post-apocalyptic land of 1990s USA.
Apparently, this being the post-apocalyptic world of Vegas, there are no cups that are in good working condition.
It looks like something happened over there and did stay there.
Buddy was either drinking out of broken glass or a melted red Solo cup. I don't know why glassware didn't survive, like no glassware at all survived the apocalypse. I mean, you have no choice but to drink your post-apocalyptic liquor out of something that's either going to give you extra carcinogens or you're going to be swallowing broken glass.
Yep.
One of the two. We start the film basically after a chaotic fight scene where the kid's mother's killed, and we move on slowly to Buddy running across the first, I guess, cantina that he runs across. Music is being played by the Red Elvises in the background, and he is immediately approached. Like, he is already being focused on by the Death's minions. The first grouping of which is the Pin Pals, all bald as a bowling ball, all wearing bowling outfits and carrying around bowling bags. So, apparently, this is a post-apocalyptic bowling-themed gang.
Yeah, the Pin Pals.
Probably the only non-musical gang in the entire group, like the entire movie.
Everything was pretty much music-influence-based or oriented.
Okay, even the Russian general, the guy that was kind of like Stalin later on in the movie, he wasn't Russian, or I want to say musically themed, but he was fighting for polka to be the big thing.
Yeah, like, he was Russian or Polish?
He was like he was Russian. He was supposed to be sort of like a post-apocalyptic version of Stalin.
He was trying to start the polka revolution.
A polka revolution in Stalin style, I guess. Because the whole idea was that mostly the entire country had been taken over by the Russians after the war. So after whatever apocalyptic event took place, the Russians pretty much took over most of America.
That was the premise, yes.
That was the premise. So the Russians still being the big bad back in the, I guess, late 90s. Was that still a big thing in the late 90s? The Russians? Russians have always been a big thing.
Got in about except for the existence of the Russian mafia. But as far as the political spectrum, some kind of a non-factor there, still doing little things here and there, but nothing like the big Russian phobia of the 80s.
I want to say, yeah, a lot of that Cold War tension kind of had melted off back then.
Yeah.
They weren't the primary focus anymore. Like, of the...
After all of USSR, that kind of, yeah.
But seeing as the movie took place in, like, 1957, that initial, you know, bombing, I guess having the Russians as the main baddie in the film, I guess is sort of accurate to the time anyway.
Yeah.
There was still a lot of tensions, especially in regards to nuclear warfare throughout the 50s, 60s, so on and so forth. Hide under your desk if a nuclear bomb goes off.
Yeah.
Like hiding under your desk is going to do anything.
It lends to a little bit of logical sense to make, because it's usually the dormant power that surprises you and attacks you when you least expect it.
You know, I was thinking about...
Basically, you're too busy watching ISIS and the Taliban, and all of a sudden the Russians drop some shit on you.
Yeah, that's probably how it's going to be. You know, you're spending too much time looking left, and everything going on the right is happening.
Exactly.
That was not a political thing. That was just a directional thing. I'm not talking left-right in politics.
But!
That works, too. I mean, that works, too.
Yes. You're looking too much up the left. And the ride is going wild.
Hey, not for nothing. I think it goes both ways right now. I'm not impressed with either political party and how they're handling
all
things.
Extremes are bad, but, you know, really, what they consider to be the radical left, what they consider to be the radical left is really not. It's just some people that want better for everybody, not just a few.
Well, I mean, both what you would consider the radical left and the radical right are doing exactly the same thing right now, fear-mongering in different ways. So fear-mongering is a big thing right now. And then also you have the issue of both political parties focusing primarily, not on the issues that need to be taken care of, but primarily on the left is concentrating on fuck you to the right, and the right is concentrating on fuck you to the left. And that's pretty much...
That's pretty much what it is, and forget the people in the process.
Childish bickering in the middle and lower class take the hit.
I feel it's a lot of formula following as far as both sides goes, where, you know, like in music, somebody got a big hit. Let's just say Lady Gaga has the big hit, the big pop hit. Just to give an example, Poker Face or something like that, and a whole bunch of artists start make a song sounding just like that right after.
Right.
So, you know, they forget about the quality because what they really want is the hit. The creativity, the originality goes out the window. They want the hit. So in this case, the formula was foster and plant the seed of the us against them mentality, the fear mongering. And, you know, you become no better than the other side that you claim you're so much better than.
That's pretty much how it happens. I mean... You spend so much time fighting against one particular ideal, and sooner or later you start becoming exactly what you're fighting against.
Fight too hard against your enemy, you might become him.
Back to the movie. We don't want to get political. Well, we do. We do frequently. I just don't want to do it this time.
Well, we just did.
Yeah, we did. We did.
For a while.
We've done it before. We'll do it again.
So the guy, he could play the guitar.
Right.
He's a badass with a sword, with a samurai sword of all sorts.
He tries to throw away his sword frequently.
It makes for an interesting combination of a film, I will say.
He tries to throw away his sword frequently throughout the film. Frequently.
Yeah.
I think he even left one behind in that initial scene, like that initial fight scene where he went against the Pin Pals. There was a sword that penetrated the gas pump, which led to the death of the fake Clint Eastwood.
That must be traumatizing. Swords keep clinging to him like diseases.
Well, that means he at least started off with three swords, ended up with two. One that was strapped to the back of his guitar, and one that he actually actively used. So he had several weapons throughout the film. I was actually impressed after being disappointed by the Pin Pals. I was. They didn't get to use their little... knives that came out of the bowling pin, which disappointed me a little bit, because literally they pulled out their knives and were cut down in one fell swoop by Buddy. But I was a little disappointed that they started off the fight scene with the pin pals pulling out maces or what are those little morning stars from their bowling bags, the little chained morning stars. I have no idea what the point of those weapons were. They are not bowling themed. You could have kept on bowling theme the entire time. Just have them pull those pin knives to start with.
Yeah.
You know, just sword on sword play, so to speak, or knife on sword play. It's like a hidden shank inside the pin.
One, you know what I thought of a creative weapon, choice of weapon, would have been turn those bowling balls into like cannonballs. The bowling balls,
right, you know,
into
like
cannonballs. But make like a big slingshot and just shoot them out.
I was thinking like they could have used the mace thing, but they should have had like little candlepin bowling balls, like the little balls on the end.
That too.
That would have been more appropriate, but they just had these, I don't know if they were skulls or whatever attached to the Morningstar. Like at the end of the chain, they looked like skulls, but you didn't get quite a good enough view to be able to tell. Highly underutilized weapons because they don't stay in hand for very long in the fight scene.
There was, you know, the little inconsistencies of the movie where the teams, the little team, little cliques, little whatever, kind of veered off theme, of topic of theme throughout, you know, whatever interactions they had with the main character. It made it kind of weird, but there were, you know, that's the only thing I could say about the whole storyline or plot that could have used some work. Other than that, it was not bad at all.
I mean, it was a low-budget student film. You have to work within certain parameters, so sometimes you kind of have to take some liberties or veer off to keep the idea going. The Red Elvises, the guys that did most of the music for the movie, they were actually supposed to have a fight scene. They were actually supposed to fight against Buddy at one point.
Yeah.
But scheduling-wise, they were already booked to do something else. So because they were not able to come back and do the fight scene, they were written completely out of the movie and killed shortly thereafter.
They killed them all.
Yeah, and it's even shown, so that point where they all poked their heads out from around the corner to kind of watch the fight as they're going on was filmed outside of the initial scene. So they were actually called back, and if you look really close, you can see the guy with the red hair is wearing a wig. Because when they finally called them back on set to do that scene, his hair had been dyed a different color already. So they had to put a red wig on him so that they could kind of keep with a little bit of consistency.
Yeah.
I think I would have forgiven them even the color change. They could have made it a running gag with a hair color change from scene to scene.
You know? Yeah, just random something that people will catch to make it like a talking point of the movie also.
He could have just been I want to say a Russian musical Dennis Rodman.
Yeah.
Right? There are little things that I watched throughout the movie that, like, after maybe the second or third watching, I kind of understood a little bit better. Like, there was that scene where they steal the car from Clint Eastwood, and they're driving down the roadway, and they're being chased by, for all intents and purposes, a roving band of cavemen, and they're being chased in a car by these cavemen that are shooting different things at them, everything from records to gumballs. I didn't realize those were gumballs at first. I didn't realize that's where the gumballs came from. So when they kind of poured out of the car when the car broke down and the kids stepped out, I didn't know where they came from at first. I'm like, where are these random fucking gumballs from?
Some stuff was like weird.
I didn't realize it was actually something being catapulted at them by the roving band of cavemen.
Yeah, there was a lot of craziness that made it entertaining, if nothing else. Some people with OCD might beg to differ, but I think it was part of what made it entertaining. There were a lot of things that could have been done that weren't, but all in all, it came out pretty good for a student film, especially.
Well, it's a movie from beginning to end that requires you to completely suspend your belief in reality. It's a complete and utter fantasy.
You sure? Yeah, you should renounce logic to watch this one.
This is
probably not watch it all the way sober, either.
I think that having been maybe had a couple of drinks or smoked a little something would have made this film a little bit more enjoyable. Though,
yeah, that's how I watched it the first time.
it has what I look for in a bad or in a low budget film. You can be low budget, you can be bad, you can have a terrible script, but if you make the actual filming of the movie so entertaining that I can't stop smiling throughout the film, that is important to me.
Yeah, the pop culture references also did a lot for this movie. I enjoyed that.
All right, we're going to go ahead and take a quick break to let our sponsors speak for themselves, and we are going to be right back to discuss the later half of this film. All right, so we can get right back into discussing the second half of the movie. Actually, I think we only got through the first maybe third of the movie and a couple of one decent fight scene. Shortly after dispatching the cavemen, which were in pursuit of him and the kid, he decides yet again that he is going to try to... Not yet again. This is the first time, I believe, that he tries to have somebody just take this kid. You, take the kid.
Yep.
He decides that he's going to pawn... That the car breaks down in front of the cannibal's house, the cannibal family. Who immediately mistakes him for somebody else completely. And these are the most unnervingly weird people in the entire film. Like, you know something is wrong with these batshit crazy people right from the beginning.
Yeah, definitely.
And anybody with even passive perception could have told, they were like, hey, we're going to eat one of you guys. Just sit here long enough.
Something's not right. Somebody should have thought, or would have thought.
They especially wanted to eat the little boy. The kid was on the meal plan. The second they saw them, oh, you're so plump, you're getting so big. Have some more candy, get some meat on those bones.
Yeah.
Candy wasn't going to put meat on that kid's bones. You needed to feed a lot more to him, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of this film, a lot of the fun of this film has to do with him constantly trying to get rid of the kid while also realizing, shit, I'm responsible for this kid. It's pretty entertaining watching him just kind of toss this kid off here and there. He tries to give him the little man. He tries to pass him off to these folks. And he's constantly trying. He's like, I don't want this responsibility. But then always falling back into the fact that, oh, well, you know, I did save this kid after his mother was killed. So he's sort of my responsibility anyway.
Yeah.
No matter how hard he tries to fight it off, he keeps coming back because he has a sense of honor and responsibility, which is a good thing. It bites him in the ass on a continual basis throughout the film.
Yeah, it would have been more productive and logical just to keep the kid from the jump.
It would have, but then it wouldn't have made a very entertaining movie, now would it have?
No.
You know, this... I mean, the kid, the whole point was the kid sort of whining and crying and like, hey, you little buddy, I'm over here. You know, what am I going to do if you're not here? Literally, like, cannibals would have eaten me or death would have killed me by now, or I would have been swallowed by, I guess, the spinach monster and the windmill people, which were a thing.
Yeah,
the windmill
much.
People. I guess I get the feeling that the windmill people were like, I don't even know what you would call them, like, I don't want to call them Satanists, but they were sacrificing people to the spinach monster, which I guess
is
Satan in the movie.
The spinach monster was kind of a deity to them.
The spinach monster looked like a hose with a lit up eye on the end. That's what it looked like, anyway.
Pretty much.
I don't even know what to do with that. It was a weird kind of underground cult. It was the only indoor set piece that you really had the entire film. Everything else was set against the backdrop of the location they filmed in. They primarily filmed throughout Death Valley, which was, I guess they had a lot of crew that kind of spun in and out and a lot of extras that kind of spun in and out of the film because most people couldn't take more than a week filming out in Death Valley. They were like, no, I can't do this anymore. Thank you. Bye.
The desert.
Well, yeah, not just the desert. One of the hottest places in all of the United States. Death Valley.
Yeah, I know.
You know, the epic scenes that they had with death on those sand dunes were actually a 20-minute walk out from the main road. So they actually chose to take all of this equipment with them 20 minutes off of the main road and out into the desert to film on those dunes.
On foot.
On foot, yeah. I think that he said something about, the director said something about using an RV to get the equipment out there, but for the most part, everybody else was on foot. They're lucky things didn't break down out there. That would have been, ooh. I can just imagine the sweat. But that kind of explains why Jeffrey looked like he was half baked and sunburnt throughout the entire film.
That would have been a struggle.
But I specifically love this little cannibal family because they are all sorts of batshit crazy. And the weird look on the little girl's face every time she looked over at the little boy, like, I'm going to eat you up. You are breakfast right there.
That was very entertaining because they really, you could see how they had normalized the whole eating people thing to a point where it didn't really seem to be phased. Like, it looked as if they expect you to know you were going to be eaten at some point and you shouldn't be surprised about
it. Well, I mean, it is a post-apocalyptic wasteland, so I imagine food is sparse. They're drinking out of broken glasses. I imagine that cannibalism was not that uncommon a thing, especially for people who didn't have direct access to food.
Those 90s were wild.
Where are you going to find growing food out in the Las Vegas desert? Think about that. I mean, I imagine right now it's probably difficult to get food out to certain parts of Las Vegas, and you would need a decent amount of money to be able to feed yourself and your family while living over there.
So, yeah, let alone after a nuclear fallout.
Yeah, nuclear fallout, post-apocalypse, you know. I'm thinking that human looked pretty fucking good. And maybe there were a few other characters that we ran across that were definitely cannibals and not exactly on the up and up. Stalin was definitely keeping himself fat on the meat of the people that were fighting for him.
Exactly.
Because he was the most plump guy in the entire film. Like, everybody else was skinny, looking like they needed the next meal to come very quickly. And Stalin was nice, big, and plump.
Yeah, those cannibals just happened to be the only out-of-the-closet cannibals.
Right, right. Well, I don't think they were out-of-the-closet cannibals either. I think they were just unhinged. Surviving. They were crazy. Nobody would outright suspect them of being cannibals only because of the fact that they were just batshit crazy. The only one that looked suspiciously like a cannibal was the little girl who couldn't seem to stop licking her lips and looking over at the kid like, we are eating this kid, right? This is our next meal?
So what time do we kill him?
Right? The little boy just looked really, really aggressive and mad.
Yeah.
And the father looked, he was definitely bipolar. He went back and forth between, bye-bye, bye-bye, bye-bye now! Go! Bye-bye!
Yeah. Just
screaming it after them. Or Buddy.
It was incredible, though. It was mad funny.
Buddy is definitely an alcoholic. Definitely an alcoholic.
Yeah. He was a drink.
He's always stopping for a drink, and shortly after giving the kid over to the cannibals, he went around the corner, fell asleep on his guitar, after having drank himself into a stupor. You have the bottle just sitting right next to his head.
Yep.
As if to say, if this kid wasn't around, Buddy would be drinking a whole lot more. A lot.
He imbibed.
Quite a bit.
Buddy was right up there with Nancy Reagan in the alcoholic.
Well, Nancy Reagan? Do you think she drank a lot?
Oh, she was an alcoholic.
Okay. I don't know enough about Nancy Reagan to really make that judgment. How do you know she's an alcoholic?
Oh, I've read it somewhere.
You know, say no to drugs, but drinking, that's okay. That's okay, kids. Go ahead, do that.
Oh, there's other things that have been coming out to surface about Nancy Reagan. Late.
She was very much a do-as-I-say-not-as-I-do kind of woman?
Well, also that she had quite an art for fellatio.
I don't know if I want to think about Nancy Reagan, of all people, fellating anyone. Like,
well,
no.
She was famous for reading Hollywood, according to what I've read. And again, because I don't like the Reagans, I choose to believe it.
She was good at blowjobs, but that's because I don't like her. Okay, that works.
Pretty much. Well, not good, because being good at it is not a bad thing.
Was she famous for bad blowjobs?
No. She was famous for not being stingy with them.
Oh, okay, so the excess thereof. Okay, I see.
Hollywood executives and everything.
So that she was first lady of the Hoover vacuum cleaner, as it is.
Pretty much.
Okay, I understand now.
Full vacuum 3000.
The Reagan vacuum 3000. Sucks
as
you blow.
Well, that was for Mary Ronald, I guess, but yeah. That was the common knowledge back in the day, according to a biographer.
Well, now I'll never look at Nancy Reagan the same way. But then again, I don't look at her much anyway, so there you go.
Moving on. After I after I read all that and saw all the memes, I will send them to you. After I read all that and saw the meme, her neck kind of looks longer now.
Well, you got the advantage of the long neck and a dulled gag reflex. Well, the alcohol will definitely numb your gag reflex after a while, yeah. Numbs a lot of other things, too.
Yeah.
So moving back into the film, Buddy, we're going to go... Well, I'm not even going to segue back into it. They're just going to run right back into the film full speed here. Buddy has to save the kid once again. He doesn't save him from the cannibals, though, mind you. The cannibals, had they not been deterred by the windmill people, the cannibals would have eaten the kid. However, the windmill people start coming out of the ground, and they were like, you know what, fuck these guys, and fuck this kid. You know what, fend for yourself, school's coming up soon, don't be late, and they run out of there with a stuffed panther or a cheetah, and leave him to fend for himself with these windmill people. So Buddy ends up once again having to save the kid, and they run into their second mode of transportation, which is a dirt bike that apparently Buddy doesn't know how to start, but the kid says, oh, you didn't turn the key. And man,
so proficient.
Apparently Buddy doesn't know how to drive dirt bikes anyway. It's like, well, if he doesn't know that you have to turn the key to turn this thing on, why do you feel safe riding on this thing with him?
I will say definitely the dark humor and the dry humor that the movie contained, the sarcastic humor that the movie contained too, made for a lot of the film, basically, because the movie itself, being so low budget, the writing of it, you could tell that effort was put into it.
There was definitely a lot of effort put into the writing. There were a lot of puns, some of them really good, some of them kind of groan-worthy. But the way that Jeffrey Falcon delivered his lines, he delivered his lines with almost a Jack Lemmon seriousness. Like, dead serious.
Black facial expressions. He said his shit with a very black facial expression.
He said his shit as if he wasn't expecting a single thing in return from anybody. Like, so, there isn't a ratchet in that bag, is there? Just ignoring whatever the guy had just said to him. It's like, I know you're crazy, but I'm looking for a ratchet. No ratchet here, sorry. So we go through the rest of the film. We've moved past him having to once again save the kid. They take a spill on their new chosen mode of transportation, which I guess decided to die as they were riding. And their version of it dying was him literally just taking a massive spill, the kid skinning his knee, and we go through what most kids do. It's very kid-like, where the kid's in pain, but if you do a pratfall or injure yourself in front of them, it distracts them from their own pain. And so he goes through these series of pratfalls, flipping himself over, hurting himself to make the kid laugh. To which the kid almost immediately goes back to crying 2 seconds later. And he's like, you know what, fuck it, I've had enough of this. And just slings the kid over his shoulder. And he stomps out of frame roughly with the kid just going, huh, with every step. It's like, you know what, kid, if you're not going to stop crying, I'm just going to forcefully give you the Heimlich maneuver over my shoulder for the rest of the way to wherever the hell we're going.
Yep, that sounds like punishment.
Yeah, definitely sounds like punishment. And then everything...
I heard that'll shut a kid up.
Well, I mean, if you've got a shoulder to their gut and you're just stomping around with them, you're not shutting them up, you're just driving the wind out of their system.
So they'll shut the hell up.
Well, I mean, if you don't have any wind in your lungs, definitely you shut up, because you can't talk. You know? You gotta gasp for air after that.
The method is unorthodox, man, but quite efficient.
It's like corporal punishment. It's like, okay, if you're not gonna shut up, then you can't breathe. Okay? That'll quiet you down real quick. No breathing? That helps? Yeah.
He rendered him speechless.
It's the same effect as just putting a pillow over the kid's face, except for less violent.
Not that he was saying much anyway, besides making sounds.
No.
But
well,
still.
He was just going to cry anyway. Might as well just, you know, march around with him sounding like he's dry heaving over your shoulder the entire time. Better than crying. And this kid knew how to cry throughout this entire film, let me tell you. Woo! Like, excessive crying. This is his approach to is this Fallout just outside of Vegas that's run by Little Man, who advises him to follow the yellow brick road? I believe his exact words were, follow the yellow brick road, homie.
That's exactly what he said.
Those guys that were standing next to him look a whole lot bigger compared to him. And I thought they were like these gargantuan looking guys until the kid sat down next to little man and the kid was just a little bit taller than little guy. And yeah. I'm looking at him like, these guys are just average height. There's, yeah, they're not gigantic. They're just gigantic in comparison to little man.
Exactly.
I think everything just kind of goes balls to the wall from here, though. I mean, it's just constant action back and forth between the initial scene with him in the bar and having to verbally fend off like this other Buddy Holly wannabe, onto him having to try to save the kid once again, who gets taken away by the cult of the spinach monster. That's all I can think. They call them the windmill people, but they're sacrificing him to the spinach monster. The fact that the main cult deity is like a myth that parents would tell their children if they didn't eat all of their greens. The spinach monster is going to come take you away.
That's exactly what that sounds like.
And the annoying kid from the beginning of the movie that yells out, "Tag, you're it," shows up, and the little kid has to defend himself against the newly resurrected "Tag, you're it" kid. Only two kids in this entire movie that were annoying as hell. The other two were just creepy. So kids,
very, very creepy.
Kids don't fare well in this movie at all. They're either annoying or creepy. Altogether, they are the kind of people that you want to just dispose of at every given turn, so I don't really give Buddy too much flack for wanting to drop the kid off at every given chance that he gets.
Well, little cannibal girl was a little bit of both.
The cannibal girl was creepy. The little boy was just mean creepy. He wasn't, like, kind of weird creepy. He was just silent and mean looking.
Yeah, every.
He looked like
kind of disturbing in a way, if it wasn't such a funny movie.
He looked like the kind of kid that would sit by an anthill with a magnifying glass, and then when the ants didn't burn quick enough for him, he'd just pour gasoline on the anthill and light a match. That's how mean he looked. Like, future serial killer mean, which is not that far off because he's already a cannibal.
Exactly. There's not that much of a leap.
My fellow man makes good food, so we're already in Dahmer territory here. We're not that far off.
Yeah, no. Pretty much.
There you go. He grows up to be a post-apocalyptic Anthony Hopkins in, Silence of the Lambs.
Went full Dahmer. Full Lecter.
Right? Full Dahmer, full Lecter. I don't think he'll have as much refinement as Lecter did at all.
Lecter was a very worldly guy. Very sophisticated and worldly. Serial killer. He was no Grim Reaper killer.
So we're going to scurry on because, honestly, the fight underground outside of the massive right that he delivers to this kid that's got at least a head and a half of height over him, outside of that, the whole underground cult scene was not all that interesting.
It wasn't.
We end up over just moving through there, actually, on the final road to, well, I guess, Vegas. Vegas, which looks like a dingy post-apocalyptic version of the Emerald City of Oz on the horizon.
That movie will do great as a video game if they could translate that into a video game storyline.
Well, I mean, 90% of what you're seeing is the basic storylines that you see, or different types of storylines that you see throughout the Fallout series. They're all set in the 50s. The entire world is locked musically into the 50s.
Yeah.
So
I've never seen Fallout is a video game, correct?
Yes, yes. There's a series of video games. I think there's Fallout 1, 2, Fallout 3, Fallout 4 was New Vegas. Then they have their most recent one, which takes place in the Massachusetts area. Like, it all revolves around Boston. But they have the Fallout Vegas game, it feels like it could have just been a side story. This movie feels like a side story to that.
Oh, wow. Well, all the listeners that haven't been with us long enough, I am kind of video game illiterate.
I didn't come into this expecting that you would know the games outside of maybe passively through one of your boys.
Yeah.
If I could recommend a video game to you, honestly, I think that you would enjoy most of the Fallout series. I think you would enjoy for the musical background to it. There's a lot of heavy musical themes in the Grand Theft Auto series. And, of course, just for the pure enjoyment of playing the game, I would also recommend Red Dead Redemption. So if you want something heavily story-based that isn't going to just be action to and fro, that you can actually enjoy a storyline with, those games are right up there.
I'll check the... I have a video game expert in the next room that I should ask that should ask about that.
But the Fallout games actually introduced my son to a lot of early 50s music that he's collecting record albums now, based off of his love for the music that he learned through these games while he was watching me play them.
Well, you guys live close to my favorite church, Welfare Records, so shout out to Welfare Records, by the way. See you guys soon.
Right. Got to get in there soon. I haven't been in there since COVID hit.
It's kind of how we went for a lot of us.
Yeah, I used to go in there frequently, and then just one day it was just, okay, well, this is definitely, I like the store, but it's very cramped to get into, and I felt like I'd be walking over people, and people do frequent that store. It's a great...
No, hey, my first proper record shop that I went to in the Merrimack Valley area, and you remember when I went there for the first time, I was like a little kid in a candy store.
And it only gets better, honestly, the longer they're there. If you get a chance, if you're in New England, if you're in the Massachusetts area, northeastern New England, Haverhill, Massachusetts, right along River Street, is a fantastic radio. It is not just a record shop. They actually sell old radios, old turntables, all sorts of stereo equipment, recording equipment in their side room. They are not just a record shop, but they actually have older equipment that they sell there too. It's a fantastic all-around shop. Welfare Records in Haverhill, Massachusetts. We'll give you a shout out. They're not even a sponsor, but we love them. But Ben fell in love with Peggy Lee through the Fallout game, and he actually got his first Peggy Lee album from them.
He should check out whenever he has the time, because a lot of this film, the music and a lot of things reminded me of, now that you bring it up, he should check out Rosemary Clooney.
Rosemary Clooney, okay.
Very old school country, but beautiful, beautiful voice.
All right, we'll definitely go ahead and keep an eye out for them. I want to keep an eye out for some of the music by the band that was featured in this film. The Red Elvises, they were actually just coming into their own as a band back when this film first was, I want to say not first released, but when this was first thought of. The guy that sat and did the direction and wrote most of the film, he actually went out and saw them in person. He's like, I love your sound so much. Would you enjoy coming and sitting down and doing the music for my movie? And they were like, yeah. Hell yeah. Yeah, we'll definitely do that. And so the Red Elvises, their music and their they themselves are featured in this film fairly prominently.
Definitely the start of a friendship with them.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed the music. It has sort of there's a bit of a surfer vibe to it. They have a little bit of a Middle Eastern sound to their music as well. It is definitely a good sort of punk rock, but also world music mashup.
Yeah, nice feel.
Their sound is absolutely fantastic, and I definitely recommend sitting down and listening to a little bit of their music, especially considering the reason that they sat through and listened to their music. The director sat down and listened to the entire set that they did was because they were drawn into the bar that they were playing at through a punk rock version of Hava Nagila.
Yeah.
So they heard that and they were like, oh my god, this is a great sound. He listened to the entire set and that's when he was like, yeah, this needs to be the music. This needs to be what's featured in this film.
Yeah, they sound great.
They did. I mean, through and through, it definitely set the feel, you know, almost beach music for a place with no ocean. So I guess we can call that sand music.
Well, the music was a lot of things, all of them good.
It was definitely one of the reasons why this film, from beginning to end, was one of the more enjoyable films that I've watched. Between the
backdrop of it, of their sound, made for it. It helped a lot in a lot of ways.
Well, a lot of films that we've watched in the past few years for this, you know, the soundtracks were primarily throwaway. You know, you could give or take the soundtracks, and it really wouldn't mean a whole lot to the actual film. There were just a handful of films that we watched that were soundtrack heavy, and if you didn't have that music, that the film would have meant so much less. You know, like things like Scott Pilgrim, you know, where the soundtrack was very important to the storytelling. I felt the same way with this, that not just the choreography and the writing, but the soundtrack itself was very important to moving along the storytelling throughout the entire film.
Yeah. And you also have unique cases. To give you an example, Die Hard, the first Die Hard, it was Christmas music.
And outside of the Christmas music, you really couldn't tell too much. I mean, yeah, it took place during a Christmas party in a corporate tower. You really
to me, it made sense, but it also the contrast with the action, the feel good Christmas music, contrasting with all the action that went on and all the killing and mayhem that went on. I love that.
I wholeheartedly agree. With the Christmas music as the background to Die Hard, I mean, it was definitely a Christmas film. It came out around that time. You know, the interactions between Alan Rickman and a very early in his career, Bruce Willis, it had a lot of that same snark that he had when he had it. He was in Moonlighting. The comedic interactions, the one-liners, the puns, just mixed with almost a John Rambo kind of action. It really felt punctuated by what should have been fairly happy Christmas music in the background.
Yeah.
So sometimes having a soundtrack in stark contrast to what is actually going on around you is a pretty good idea, too.
And then the sidekick, unwittingly sidekick, was the most wholesome cop you could ever see.
Yes, Carl. Carl from the Family Matters television show. God, what is his name? That's a problem. See, having to come up with names off the top of my head, I know so many people by face and not so much by name. So
Mr.
You bring,
Winslow?
Yeah, well, I know his name's Mr. Winslow, or he was Carl Winslow in the show, but that's not his actual physical name. His name is Reginald Vel Johnson.
Yeah, that's who he is.
But that's people that I know for you know, he was actually very famous as a bit actor in a lot of different things. I mean, he had a stint that his show was a spinoff of the Perfect Strangers television show. The Winslows were featured in several episodes when a lot of it was revolving around them working for a newspaper. But we'll go through with the last couple of scenes of this film, featuring the two biggest fight scenes in the entire film. One of them being the, I guess, Buddy Holly versus Stalin and his polka mercenaries, I guess.
Okay.
That's all I can call them. I mean, they're supposed to be like Russian soldiers, but they're all fighting for Polka to be the main thing when they want Stalin to be the next king, I guess.
Well, they were prepared to take... If you don't want to give Polka its place in the pop culture landscape, they're ready to take it by force.
Hey,
that was their...
I'm sorry, they missed a beat there. If you want Polka...
Very much so.
If you want Polka... If you want somebody to be the king of polka in New Vegas, why didn't they have Weird Al in this film?
Well, probably would have been expensive.
I mean, think about it. If there's anybody that emulates polka in modern times, even back in the 80s, really, 80s, 90s, today.
Yeah.
Almost everything that Weird Al does has a polka undercurrent.
It does.
I could have seen Weird Al on the throne in New Vegas. Weird Al is the new king. I found it very interesting that the main battle that took place... Okay, so you have him fighting against all of these people that come at him almost weaponless. So it's an entire army of soldiers with no weapons. They're not shooting at him. They're just coming at him in hand-to-hand combat. You have this one weird red-headed guy that is supposed to be... I don't know what style of martial arts that was supposed to be. Whether it was monkey style or... It was just batshit crazy slap fight style, for as far as I was concerned.
That's what that... It wasn't monkey style.
No, I don't know what it was. He was just flailing his arms in a windmill. Maybe windmill style, as in windmill guitar?
Probably so.
That's what I thought that was, because there's a lot of musical puns throughout this entire film. You know? Yeah. He you know, Death kills a mariachi band in the film. Death kills... He kills country in this movie. He's trying to kill old school rock and roll by killing Buddy Holly. Buddy Holly takes out polka music. Yeah, they're just destroying musical genre after musical genre.
They went through the whole gamut.
Essentially, this entire film is a musical version of King of the Hill.
Yep. Yes, it is true. I agree.
Punk rock music decides to just keep in the background, like, I'm not even fighting for... They're not even fighting for a seat. They're just like, we're going to do our own thing, and you guys just fuck you and fight for whatever.
It's kind of what punk rock always has been.
Right, exactly. So I appreciate all the nuances musically, like all the commentary that they're making without physically saying anything.
There was a lot of musical knowledge behind the writing, I can tell you that.
They hung hip-hop out to dry when they hung up Little Man, you know?
Yeah.
I even like the idea that technically the windmill people, windmill being a thing that they used to do in, oh god, horrible rock musicians doing that windmill, that da-da-da, the windmill arm movement when you're playing electric guitar.
The whole thing.
But I thought it was funny that he could cut down this entire army worth of Russian soldiers, and then he gets to Death. And his caring for this kid is both a positive throughout the movie, but also ultimately the thing that kills him. Defending this child who was, it turns out to be the one that's actually going to ascend the throne in New Vegas. Here's the thing. I'm wondering if the kid represented Christian rock.
Possibly.
Because if you think about it, Death is supposed to be like the emulation of heavy metal, hard rock, so on and so forth. And this kid spits on Death, and he's like, oh, okay. Well, apparently any water that I touch is holy water to you. So he sprays him down with the water that he has taken from the puddle.
Yeah.
So, this little kid is like the Jesus figure to Death's Satan, so to speak.
Yeah. A child savior. A lot of religious undertones in that too.
So they made sort of a heavy biblical reference, and this kid takes on the clothes of Buddy Holly, who is his savior. He basically takes Buddy's clothes, and as he walks that last path down to we don't get to see them actually go into New Vegas, or New Vegas, that's not what it is, into Vegas and ascend the throne, but you see him walk down there and slowly turn into Buddy, or a version of Buddy. Which leads me to believe that they really could have made a sequel revolving around the kid and his being on the throne in Vegas.
Yeah, could have.
But I'm glad they didn't.
Arguably should have.
I mean, they could, but I think that you would have to go somewhere other than musical for a sequel. You know what I mean?
You know what would have made it make sense for a sequel? If Buddy would have trained the kid with a sword and told him to play the guitar. Both.
That is very true. I'm trying to figure out, like, musically the kid doesn't do much other than kind of, throughout the entire film. So,
but that there would have been the perfect setup for a sequel.
Musically, in a world that is basically, you know, people fighting to be musically relevant, who should be on top, what is the best genre, in a movie that's fighting to be musically relevant, to make the one person that makes no music throughout the film, basically the one that ascends the throne, the fact that he really doesn't present anything. He doesn't present a particular genre. That's why I was wondering if it was like a Christian rock thing. He doesn't play guitar. He doesn't wield the samurai sword like Buddy does. All he does is spit and squirt water.
Exactly.
So that's kind of where what I'm kind of wondering. Like, what was the point? like to making this kid who has no musical affiliation the savior or the main protagonist, the man that ascends the throne, when nobody else in this film was anything but musical. Everybody had sort of a musical undertone to what they were doing.
To be honest, because of everything, I'm team set a sequel on that, but basically they should have set it up for it, and it would have made, you know, just to make it make more sense. Train the kid to play the guitar, train the kid with in the art, you know, swordsmanship, and go from there, and the kids, basically take the kid through a musical knowledge course through the film. And that would have set up perfect for a sequel for probably Six String Samurai 2, where the kid is probably a teen, basically a little skinny teen that nobody will think nothing of, wearing a suit and glasses, who is deadly with a sword.
I feel like the best way they could do it based off of what they did with the film would be to just sort of say that this kid, having had Buddy sacrifice himself so that he could ascend the throne in Vegas, it probably would have been a good idea to maybe give it that feel like, okay, this guy saved me. I'm going to dedicate my entire life to his style. You know?
Watch the guy sit down and watch the guy listen to this and then sit down and write the sequel.
I think that it would be sort of like a modern day take on the Buddy Holly style of music. Six String Samurai 2, but the kid would have to have a name too. He couldn't just be the kid. I mean, he could definitely be Buddy in the second movie too.
He could be the kid until halfway through the second film, just a Kill Bill. We didn't know the bride's name until like halfway through part two.
Well, I kind of like the idea of him being like naming himself, dubbing himself Buddy when he ascends the throne, like saying, "Hey, you know, I'm gonna basically be like the man that saved me." And Buddy's not gonna get to ascend the throne, but if I embody everything that Buddy was, take his name. The kid doesn't have a name throughout the film, so why not call him Buddy?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense too.
All in all, how do you feel about the film? You know, best, worst scenes, you know, all together.
The worst scene to me, I guess because I felt for the kid, was basically trying to pawn him off to the cannibals. I didn't like that at all. To me, the best scenes, I don't have one favorite. I love the action scenes, but I also love the dark humor behind everything. I don't have a favorite scene, to be honest. I love the way the action and the humor always seems to balance each other off. Because there was humor in the action, but then there was darkness in the humor.
I think my favorite scene in the entire film has to be Buddy versus the Polka Army of Stalin. I think that's probably my favorite scene in the entire film. Just that whole action sequence. They had little explosions going off, but it didn't seem like anybody had any weapons.
Yep.
All in all, probably the best fight sequence in the entire movie, so I enjoyed that thoroughly. It was a pretty lengthy fight sequence too. The worst thing that I think went throughout the entire film, when he was in Fallout and he talks this kid down from fighting him, like, "You don't want to be me, kid. You don't want to be me." And he goes out into the desert and the kid follows him with what looks like a scimitar. I think that was sort of an unnecessary scene. You didn't need to have him kill this kid. Like, having to kill this kid to prevent him from ascending the throne, and then him realizing, you know what, maybe I don't want to be king. He throws the sword down, and this is actually the first chance that the kid gets to speak throughout in the film. Like, no, you would make a good king. You would definitely make a good king.
Yeah, it was kind of redundant.
It gives the kid the chance to speak for the first time, but I think that there are so many other moments that he could have just said, you know what, I don't want this, I don't need this.
Yeah, there was some redundance to that, and probably not having that scene there would also be part of a setup for a sequel of it.
True, very true. All in all, I enjoyed the film completely from beginning to end.
Especially for the film and now knowing what we know about it.
I've watched it several times over the years. I had a VHS copy a long time ago. And I'll tell you one little story that I learned from the film itself. The most humbling thing that the director ever realized, the thing that gave him his most humbling moment in Hollywood. He had finished his film, and it was set for a premiere. And he went to the place where the premiere was going to be. And he saw this massive line of people. And he was like, oh my God, are all these people here to see Six String Samurai? And yeah. So he's walking along this group of people, and the most humbling moment he can remember is walking up and realizing that his film at this theater was being released the same day as the original Rush Hour film was being released. And realizing that all these people were here to see Rush Hour, not his film.
He had a long way to go still.
He had a long way to go. But in all honesty, if you haven't seen this film, and I'm saying this now, after having ruined 90% of it for anybody that's listening, go see it. Nothing that we're talking about, nothing we're saying here can honestly describe the cinematography and the action sequences and just how this movie was made better than actually sitting down and watching it.
The crazy storytelling of the whole, the way they set everything up.
There are so many ways this film could have just absolutely failed as a film, and it didn't. It was so good.
It was.
Mind you, you can't take my word. Take Omar's word for it. He actually appreciates a lot of really good films. I love bad fucking movies. So, taking my word for it, you got to take it with a grain of salt.
No, I enjoyed it because it was very crazy, but had some deep undercurrents to it that I really enjoyed throughout the film, that it gives you a lot of the tiny aha moments if you're really paying attention.
Exactly. I mean, it was pulled together very nicely. You could tell that they worked very hard on it. For such a low-budget film, they shouldn't have been able to pull off some of the massively beautiful cinematic sequences that they did.
And the story, the writing creativity that they were able to achieve with this, too.
And think about the fact that they did everything on such a tight budget and filmed it in the middle of the desert in Death Valley, Nevada.
Of all places.
He chose Death Valley as the place to film. And the fact that he had that kind of dedication to get the film that he did in the place that he filmed it, it's a testament for how great this film really is. And more people should definitely sit down and watch it a few times just to appreciate how everything fell together for that.
Exactly.
All right. So I think we've gone ahead and talked at length about this film. Thank you, Omar, for joining me for the film today.
But of course.
And for our listeners, you can find us on, you can find us pretty much anywhere. Facebook, Twitter, Spotify. We are on most of your podcast apps. We are now on iHeartRadio. We are pretty much anywhere that you'd want to find us. So reach out, contact us, tell us films that you'd like us to watch. Tell us what films that we've reviewed that you've loved. And as Miss B is always particularly fond of saying as we exit, drink your water, you thirsty bitches.
Please do. Not enough hydration going on in the world.
That shit does not sound quite as good tumbling out of my mouth as it does from Nico at all.
Never. But, you know, we still honor her with that because it's a great saying.
I honor her by fumbling the line and sounding absolutely uncomfortable saying it. That's how I honor her.
It's okay. I don't mind saying thirsty bitches because some bitches be thirsty.
Drink your water, you thirsty bitches.
You bums.